This episode of Super Pulp Science is brought to you by Gear and Sea by Claire C. Marshall. Friendship, jealousy, and the guts to choose between them intertwine in this brand new adventure of the Silent Guardian series, A World of Robots and the Kids Who Love Them, created by GMB Kamichuk and Justin Curry. Available at fairyinkpress.com.
Attention, citizens! It's time for Super Pulp Science!
This is Super Pulp Science, where we talk about how genre gets made. I'm here with my long-suffering co-host, Justin Curry, known the world over as Chasing Artwork, and our producer extraordinaire, Dan Vadimoncur. How you doing, guys?
Hello!
Hello!
Doing well.
our pandemic audio foibles continue as we are in different locations yet again, recording our podcast and trying all kinds of different things to get you the very best in mediocre audio quality.
Hey, you know,
we're trying our best.
It's the standard now. It really is. Every time you look, turn on the TV, someone's being interviewed over Zoom, or it's just the way things are done now. So I think people are very forgiving of it, to be honest. I think people are not complaining as much as they normally would be in under different circumstances. So I think it's okay.
Yeah.
I hope so. Yeah. If you've stayed with us this long, you've put up with a lot worse than barely being able to hear one of us. On that topic of restrictions and like just adjusting to the way things are, I had a very interesting meeting yesterday. I'm on a script development sort of retainer right now. So I'm working with a media company, just doing some idea development. And we had a producer meeting yesterday. So two of the producers are sitting in saying things like, okay, give us your ideas. So we pitch, me and this other person pitching ideas. What you got for us? So we throw 8 or 12 ideas at them. Nope. No kids. No, we can only have these three locations. It has to be this place and this place. We can have this many actors. We want to, you know, like they're just building out all of the, we want all of your ideas. And now that we've heard them, here are some more restrictions that are going to go around that idea. Right.
Why do you think they do that? Why didn't they give you that list of haves and have nots prior to hearing the ideas?
We had worked with a list already. We'd been given some restrictions. Okay. Then when we were going through that list, they said, okay, clearly what had happened is over the week or two while they were brainstorming also about what kind of restrictions the mechanics of filming would create. We started doing that. We've been really, and just for context, I mean, we can't talk about the individual projects because they're not greenlit or I don't have the permission to share the internal workings of who's involved in whatever. But these are not big budget, big productions. These are small productions. And what we're trying to figure out are ways in which you can film with the restrictions that are likely to linger for a good long while around COVID. So how to do really closed bubble where the actors can be tested. They can remain for the whole shoot, cared for by the production. The crew would also join in that bubble, stay for the whole time. You know, these kinds of things where we could be ultra, ultra safe for everyone involved. And could you work under those conditions? What kind of stories could you make given only a couple locations, only a couple of actors, a crew of 4 or 5, right? Mm-hmm. What kind of stories would you tell under those conditions that are achievable under a certain, under budget X, time Y, and Gen Z? What are those details? And so I've been thinking a lot about, like Cube. Oh my God, Cube. So good. And I got off of that call, you know, and then did another call with a client who has hired me to do this book mentoring, and I am imposing all kinds of my restrictions on them, right? Here's some story structure restrictions here. You know, you have too many characters. You have too many panels per page. You have, too much of this, not enough of that. So I was thinking about restricting, like it was really on my mind. And then I'm doing some illustration work for a project after that, long into the wee hours of the night. And I listened to the 3 hours worth of documentary, details that go into the making of Aliens. So there's like lots of material and footage and documentaries around how that movie was made. Mm-hmm. And it exists in science fiction history, I think, as an immersive, immense science fiction opus. But man, did it ever have a lot of restrictions around the filming and around the just the needs. And I've just been really focusing on this idea that you almost need those pressure. You need those walls. We've talked about this a little bit before, Justin, that like knowing the page count ahead of time, knowing the publishing date ahead of time, those are things you work for. But I wonder if we've gotten too soft in the amount of restrictions that we've been putting on ourselves. And should we try more stringent limitations on some of our creative projects?
Like we're a little too blue sky. We don't have enough restrictions because we're in charge for a lot of these projects.
Right. That's exactly right. And maybe we get along too well. What all these stories that I've been listening to is like everyone fights all the time. And yet as somehow this wonderful like the story of Aliens is very clearly a story of warring production crews, warring producers, warring cultures, literally, because it was filmed in the UK and the American filmmakers did not get along with the UK attitude towards filmmaking.
I listened to a podcast about this recently. It was about the podcast was about James Cameron, but they did definitely cover that that chapter as far as him quarreling with the like fighting with the crews, and it was kind of like, and I think George Lucas had similar issues with Star Wars as well, because there's a different culture in the UK as far as filmmaking goes, correct?
Yeah, very different. And
tea time, everything shuts down at tea time. Doesn't matter if you need to get that shot, we shut it down, we stop, we have our tea.
Yeah, like, maybe more civilized.
Yeah.
So what was amazing is, you know, the British crew members also extremely polite in how they're answering. Many of them were on camera answering. But what they did to underline how there was clearly a problem was they did almost like a supercut of everyone saying the same kind of thing. Right? Like, oh, well, there was just one or two tense moments, but we all figured it out. And then everyone telling some version of a tense moment, but they're all in different departments. And so when you put it all together, you realize that every day was full of tense moments in every department. Every department had one or two tense moments. So, oh my goodness. But they're just trying so hard not to, you know, complain uphill, as it were.
Yeah.
But when you put the facts together, you just realize, like, man, the pressure cooker. But it produced a seminal work. Right? Like, it's really a powerful film. You know, whether you like genre films or not, you can't watch Aliens and doze off.
No.
Yeah.
You're in it.
You'll have terrible, terrible nightmares if you try that.
That's it, man. Game over, man. It's game over.
That's a story that we don't hear too often, but I'm sure is quite common, is like a book or a movie is given too big of a budget and that hurts it more than helps it. You know, if they only had 9 months to film that movie instead of 16 months and half the budget, it would have been, you know, a cult classic, but instead it was an overproduced, terrible film that everybody forgot. Yeah, and how do you figure out when, like, how do you figure that out, right? Like, is it just experience to know, like, what the constraints should be and when it helps and when it hurts?
Well, and I've been thinking about this a lot in the context of bookmaking, too, because, you know, we talked in the last podcast episode, or at least the last one we recorded, about doing books for the European, French, or foreign language markets that are silent comic stories, where all the storytelling is in the picture. But what's really at play there, the decision for that restriction, the self-imposed restriction of telling silent stories, still has to do with market forces, right? It's still like, well, the reason to make this change is so that it can, so this weird book can sell in 10 countries, a couple thousand copies times 10 countries is better than a couple thousand copies in one country in one language, right? And so you start to make certain concessions for that, and it changes your creative process. So I'm working on this manuscript, just making some adjustments. It's already in with the publisher, and I think I have an agreement in principle for this particular one. But as I was adding some content, I found myself making different choices in layouts. It affected my storytelling. And I don't know necessarily if it made it better or worse, but I felt very focused on the idea of, you know, in film, it would be the edit, like transitioning from one image to the next. Does it convey the right meaning, right? We're going to add a musical cue, and we're going to add dialogue on top of that. And in film, you can say a lot. But removing the ability to clarify with any kinds of words or text, I found myself much harder on my own illustrations to say, like, this doesn't actually convey information. Mm. This is just mood. Okay, fine. If this is just mood,
right,
it's not getting us anywhere.
Whereas before, you'd think it was acceptable because you can fix the visual cues with text, right? Like,
yeah, that's right.
Oh, that it's not a very tense scene, but hey, I can just add dialogue or text to make everybody know that it's supposed to be really tense right now.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That's exactly it. And so those restrictions, right, that pressure cooker, in this case, you know, obviously I don't have the same restrictions as a $18 million Hollywood movie in the 80s in a foreign country 6 weeks from release with no final edit done, right? I don't have those kind of pressures in my life, thankfully. But there are some ways to create those pressures. It does create a hyper-focus in you when you are not allowed to just do what you know would work if you had enough time or resources. When you purposely limit that number of resources, it can get you thinking in the many different ways. Like, we ended up story breaking last night in a completely different direction than we would have if we could have five locations, right? We were trying to focus on two locations, maybe three for this. But no, we're not going to do that. We have an outside space, we have an inside space, and we have a very small cast. How are we going to make that work? What is a compelling story to be told there? And I found that it's the reverse. You start thinking about what are dramatic things people will say. What are the key moments that the characters will emote? What are the things that are going to not be about where you are, but what they're doing and what they're saying? And just switching my brain between that and then working on this project that had no dialogue, right? Yesterday, I was a pretty... I did a lot of mental gymnastics over the course of a 10-hour workday yesterday. But I actually felt pretty invigorated. Like, when my day was over, I still wanted to keep going, because suddenly when it was like, okay, all my half dues are done, now I can do whatever I want, I had this moment where I was like, oh, if I want to use color or tone or dialogue or, you know, not do anything, I can do whatever I want now. I'm just making something up for the sheer fun of it. And I didn't want to go to bed after.
So would you say, like, you just have like a new appreciation for restrictions?
Yeah, I do, very much so. Now, I hear some weird creature scuttling around. I think it's on your end of the phone, Justin.
Maybe some squeaking.
Yeah, maybe. What is that?
It might be a dog toy.
Oh my god!
I was like, honestly, I feel like we should just not explain it. I think I should cut that little part out, and we should go to the podcast and not explain what that noise is.
Yeah.
Let people
and squeak it more often.
Somebody might need to go for a walk, and instead I'm just playing tug of war with her.
You're a good dog owner.
Restrictions are a good thing because it helps shape the creativity, right? It helps point you in the right direction. Otherwise you don't know where to start, or you don't know where to go. So I think there's a lot of times, and what I try to do when I'm like giving students an assignment, I try to give them a little bit of restrictions, not very much. I think of it more like structure. Give them some structure to help point them in the right direction, and then let them go. So it's not too much, just a little bit, right? Just a little bit of restrictions are okay.
Mm-hmm. And it helps you know when to deviate. You know, like I have this structure. It's like almost like a diagnostic brainstorming tool that I use when I'm doing substantive edits on other people's work. So for a comic book story, 22 pages is pretty common for the length of a comic book, like a single issue of a comic. And so I have it broken down in beats that are 22 pages long. And it's basically a hybrid of Dan Harmon's story wheel and the hero's journey. But whereas the hero's journey is for like epic poems and enormous legends, and Dan Harmon's is for television, right? This is specifically for comics. It is a way in which you can create a framework and very rapidly pace out 22 pages of a comic. And it forces a person who is like wondering, is there work paced properly for the comic book market? Can it work? And it really, you know, it rattles some cages when you're like, no, you'd have to cut that page, and this is too long, and that's too short, and shorten it, right? And so we finally got one of these people that I have as my students online into the rhythm of cutting their work to this format. And as soon as they were like, okay, I've got it down in this format, I was like, yeah, well, it won't work on this issue. We shouldn't follow it for this issue. And they were just so like the rug pulled out of them. They're like, I finally listening to my teacher, and I finally understand what it is you're trying to say. And I'm like, well, then that's perfect. That's exactly when you should break the rules. Right. Like,
yeah,
that's, we've taken it from taking you 3 weeks to get to a first draft of a comic book script to now 3 days. That's the purpose of that tool. Now that you can get a script out of yourself in 3 days, now you can ignore the structural elements, because now you understand how to rapidly generate an idea that fits a framework that people can read and criticize or evaluate. Now you play with that form, right? But you need that pressure of no, cut that, no, it doesn't fit, no, it's no good, no, it's terrible, and it hurts your feelings for a first little while, but once you get into that rhythm, I find it really useful.
Look, those two specimens are worth millions to the bioweapons division, right? Now if you're smart, we can both come out of as heroes, and we will be set up for life.
And then you sent this email, and we will be a little bit vague about this too. You sent me an email, Justin, just now from a publisher that said, hey, we like one of these books that you're doing. We'd like to release it into a different market. Here are some changes you'd have to make in order for it to fit this specific type of marketing for this specific kind of book market for these specific readers. And here are some suggestions of those changes. Man, it can get you prickly. My first thought was like, so it's F not, you, our book's great. And then I was like, what?
It seems strange to me that they would do that. I thought it would just be a simple translation. Like, you just translate the... And I know that languages are different, and certain situations are, you know, some things... We know that things get lost in translation all the time, but it's funny that they would actually say that you had to change the story.
See, in this specific instance, I'm talking about two different things. So one of them is a graphic novel that I'm writing and illustrating that is with publisher A, we'll say. And publisher, the thing I'm talking about right now with Justin and I is for some of our all ages material with publisher B, a different publisher. We have a couple of different irons in a few different fires right now. Mm-hmm. And one of them was, you know, a very reasonable set of conclusions to draw from how the business of book selling works. But man, that can be frustrating because you have to decide. You know, there's a real difference between the reason you make something and the purpose you sell it, right? Like a physical copy of a book for sale is doing a certain job. But the reason to write that book also did a certain job. And only in a very small place do those two things overlap enough that you're willing to change, right, the reason for it, for the purpose of sale. And that can, you know, it gets prickly. So I'm going to reread that email again and then percolate over it, Justin.
So, well, here's my thing. Cause So basically the, getting too much into it, basically one of the books, they thought the cover was more geared to an older audience than it should be. That my illustration on the cover of this book was kind of appealing to like teens to young adults, and they thought it should be revised to appeal to a younger audience. And yeah, the first reaction is always like, oh no, they're wrong. And then I percolated on it and kind of like realized all my artwork is geared towards like 15 to like 35. So like, of course,
yeah,
they're right. That's like all my stuff.
The artistic direction comment, I agreed with completely. Yeah. The content, I disagreed with wholeheartedly. But sometimes that's the problem. Your heart is not rational, right? So yeah. That's why I'm saying I have to percolate on it. I have to let my feelings for how that came across as almost criticism fade so that I can look at it objectively for the purpose of selling that book to that market.
And you know what? I don't even think I really read that part. I was too fired up about the artwork comment to read it too carefully. So I will also have to go back and see this.
I'm not even the writer on it. No, I'm not the writer on it. So I'm feeling protective of somebody else's work also in this particular
I don't know how the person phrased this, but you definitely don't want to, you have to treat the stuff delicately because egos are involved here. And this is your work, your creative work. You put all your blood, sweat, and tears into it. So yeah, you should be, you know, if you're going to be pitching this kind of stuff to people, you got to be careful about how you say it. Like that sounds. It sounds like
it's also too like when. I don't think at all. I think we're exaggerating a bit, but okay. It was. Everybody's being professional and good.
Good, 100%.
But there's something about
perfect
when
email.
Yeah,
couldn't have been worded better, in my opinion. The perfect delivery. It's my receiver that is crooked, not the delivery system.
Yeah. When a project is finished, that's when that's when the criticism. Like defensive net like really gets tight, right? Like when something's in production, when you're fooling around with ideas, like it's really easy to take criticism and balance the pros and cons and implement and do different. But when the project's done and printed, it's almost like it can't be changed anymore. So it's so much harder to get like changes on a project that's already out into the world because you feel like it's finished.
It is.
And the chances are done. Yeah.
It is finished. That's the problem.
I wonder too, is one of the reasons why this is so irksome to me, and now I'm glad to hear to you as well, Justin, is that when we are not at the finish line on a project, I'll take it all apart right down to the bones again. Like I have no trouble adjusting during creation or someone saying, yeah. No, that's no good. Let's start over. Or you got to redo those 20 pages. Right. When we're in that act, my empathy is high for the needs of the overall project. And my ego is very small, but when the project is finished, my empathy and it like all that energy goes back into my ego and it's like, we made this is it now, right? There it is.
Yeah,
now I must defend the thing that we made, and that I think is clearly at play. So like I'm aware that the problem in this potential interpersonal communication nightmare is in if I were to respond too quickly. And so I have to respond carefully and with some self-analysis. So that's where I'm at with that one. And dear listener, I had just read that email like 10 minutes before this podcast. So that's also why it's on my mind.
This is fresh. Yeah.
I was just while you guys were talking, I looked into this, and this is actually something that happens for film quite often. I don't know how often it happens for books, but I found a looper listicle here that changed for other countries, right? Things that are changed about the movie. One example here, you guys remember Captain America, the Winter Soldier? There's a great,
yes.
When at the beginning of the movie, when he first meets, what's his name? Falcon. And, he's talking about, you know, he gives him tips on things to check out, 'cause he's been frozen for 75 years. So he has that little book of things he's got to check out. Like, here's something you should check out. And he's like, okay. And he writes down, right? He's got a little list of things he wants to do. Apparently that list was different in every country.
Of course it would be. Yeah.
So where American viewers got I Love Lucy, Russian audiences got a Yuri Gagarin name drop, South Korean fans got a reference to the game Dance Dance Revolution. So they basically just changed that list for whatever country it went into. So I thought it's kind of interesting that they do this on a regular basis. But I guess that doesn't really affect the story. It's a minor detail, right? It doesn't affect the story.
Well, that brings me to this. Yeah, totally. That brings me to this idea that people talk about a lot about, you know, and we talk about it at all levels, giving the fans what they want, right? People say it's good. They say it's bad. They, you know, whatever. But there are elements in your story. If your story is situated within a pre-existing genre, where you have to know what those fans want, and you should give it to them, right? You don't make a, you know, like a movie like Psycho Gorman, right? Is a movie that is, you know, we talked to the, or I guess for FanQuest, we talked to the creator of that with you, Dan.
Yeah. Steve Kostansky.
You put in giant foam latex monster, you know, demons and Satanism. That's what that genre of film does, right? That's what the fans have gone to see. And so you give it to them. It's not a movie that has a lot of moralizing in it.
Have you seen it?
Because I
thought it wasn't out yet.
It was out. They did a screening through the Cinematheque that you could watch remotely. So anyway, the point I'm making here is that if you go to the Aliens movie, right, and you don't see the alien, you're mad. You've got to give the fans what they want. They came to see an alien. It's why Prometheus, people were so angry at it, because they kept teasing that it's the lead up to the aliens and that aliens are in it and alien, and then there isn't an alien in it. I mean, there's aliens in it, sure, but not the one. There's no xenomorph you came to see, right?
Or the that Del Toro love story that was marketed as a horror story.
Crimson Peak, a beautiful gothic romance that has ghosts in it but is not a ghost story.
But yeah, somebody along the line when they were making the trailer and making the marketing material goes like, okay, it's love stories can't have monsters in them. So this is a horror movie. So we're going to, you know, package it as a horror movie. Another one like that was Invisible was a movie I really liked, came out like, I want to say like 2007, 2008, 2009, somewhere in there. And the trailer for it is so different than the movie itself. It's like... Yeah, they're trying to trick you into seeing it by making a trailer for the movie that they think you want to see, not the actual film itself.
I hate that stuff. But I do understand when an editor, in this case, not even an editor, when a marketing person comes in and says, hey, if we want people to buy this book in this particular demographic market, these are the things that have worked in the past. They're not making stuff up. They're looking at past data for past books, comparing with an eye on what the future will be if we match those same trends. The problem with that is that it ends up in the grand like projection of art making, becoming a snake that is eating its own tail. Right? You end up only making more of what's selling, which actually narrows and narrows the idea and narrows the idea. And you end up with so many things that are just derivative elements of,
because nobody tries anything new. Everybody just reproduces what was successful in the past until the market gets tired of that and moves on to something else. Right. Why they eventually switch up, is they keep doing it until they start to lose money and then they just switch gears.
That's right. They keep doing it until someone makes Gods of Egypt and then they stop.
I thought you meant, isn't it the Scorpion King? Isn't that one, the one that's really bad?
Oh, God. No.
Or was it the one with the, what was the third Mummy movie had the CGI rock in it? Remember that?
Yeah.
That was the first
man.
That was so bad.
Yeah, that CGI rock was really bad, but that was pretty cutting edge CG at the time.
It was, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
I still really enjoyed that movie.
People away.
That's, yeah.
Oh, yeah, the Mummy movie.
Yeah,
they know what they're trying to be, and they give a lot of fan service, right? But they don't pretend to be a different thing, and I think that's what it is.
I thought you never missed, Bishop.
You never said anything about an android being on board. Why not?
It never occurred to me. It's just common practice. We always have a synthetic on board.
I prefer the term artificial person myself.
I think, and that's what it is that irks me about those kinds of comments from the marketing department, is the marketing department is saying like, okay, if we pretend that your book is this other thing that people are buying now, we'll sell more copies.
Right.
That to me is dishonest. That's at its heart a dishonest maneuver, right?
But how do you convince them that your direction is better than a proven direction, right? Like you have data. Yeah, you have no data to say like your book is going to sell better than Twilight. They just want a Twilight ripoff with a different cover.
And let's face it, nothing we do will ever sell better than Twilight. So it's easy. It's easy to throw stones, but it's hard to knock it down.
Never seen that.
Right. Oh no, it's okay. I have no illusions here, Dan. I'm a very happy person. Someone recently asked me, what I thought the meaning of life was, and I said, I was being tongue in cheek, but I was being 100% honest at the same time. I said, just to die happy. Right. Like I don't need to die rich, and I don't need to die famous, but I'd like to die happy. Right. I'd like to know that the things I was trying to do, I was engaged in the meaningful struggle of those things. And if, you don't always make it, that's how the world is. And that's okay. As long as you can continue to struggle meaningfully, then it's all right. As soon as your struggles feel meaningless, that's when despondency sets in. Right. So, and I think, and I've talked to those authors who have made every change that they can on behalf of the marketing department, and then it didn't move the needle. It didn't sell the books. And that's when despondency sets in. They feel like those changes were then all meaningless. Why didn't they stick to their guns? Why didn't they say no? Why didn't they tell you what the book was really about? And then often you'll see books that get rebranded later as what they really were. You know, like it goes through the life of a book. It tries to be the next Twilight. No, it's not. Oh, actually, it's the next Hunger Games. No, it's not. Right. And the books just keep getting rebranded as a comparison. And we're partially to blame for that, Justin, those comparison slug lines, because we teach them in our workshops.
But that's because it's a good way of, it's an easy and very effective way to communicate what a story is by comparing it to other stories. You know, we've talked about this before as well.
Yeah, it works.
It works.
Yeah. But I think there is an element to it that is exactly for those kind of marketing people, right? Like if you tell them this is Zelda mixed with District 9, they're like, oh, those are two successful things. People right. will go for that. I think I just, that was Arkland, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
Zelda. That was Arkland. Yeah. And you still remember it.
Scott Ford.
Yeah.
Yeah. The only word you missed was humble fantasy. That was his other catchphrase. And this stuff is on my mind again because tomorrow I'm participating in a television pitch, like a speed dating with producers. So it's through Zoom, and a television production company here in Manitoba has organized it. And, you know, you can pitch, you send a few weeks ahead, which I did a few weeks ago, the series or film or whatever it is that you're wanting to pitch. And then you get, you know, 15 minutes or something to come in and pitch that to a bunch of different people, 15 minutes at a time.
Cool.
You must use those kinds of tricks in those meetings.
Yeah.
They're absolutely necessary for those meetings. But I wonder, are we training audiences to only compare to existing properties?
Probably.
By using it outside of those meetings, right? I think that's has, you know, the ramifications of this, I'll be dust by the time the ramifications of this media
end. Do you just need to, you need to play by the rules and make your, like it's Hunger Games meets Harry Potter. You need to play that game long enough that like you're successful enough to be like isn't that what Nolan kind of did, right? Like he gets to do the crazy movies that he wants now, because he proved himself over and over and over again. So now he has carte blanche, right? Like do whatever craziness you want, but yeah. You have to work yourself up to that point. You can't just start doing the craziest thing because you don't have any kind of track record. So you're gonna have to play the game for a bit until you have that track record. And then you can start to do the crazy things.
I agree with that in principle, yeah. But Nolan, by example, had to make Memento as an independent film. He had to succeed first without studio money and make studio level money on a movie that didn't need their help. And then they're like, oh, now we'll help.
And it was a pretty weird movie to begin with. Like it was a weird, different movie. He did it his own way regardless. Like that was kind of the beauty of that whole thing, right?
That's right.
And it worked and people liked it. And then he got, well, the Batman movies and stuff.
Well, in the Batman movies, he was working with a proven editor. David S. Goyer was the writer of those Batman movies, which you may or may not know, dear listener, as the writer of all the Blade movies and the director, unfortunately, of the last one.
Last Blade movie?
Yeah.
Ryan Reynolds.
Yeah, well, if you watch that movie with the director's commentary on, you can hear the pain of David Goyer and the studio problems.
Speaking of movie difficulties, didn't Wesley Snipes was difficult on that one, wasn't he?
Stop,
there's the famous last scene. There's the very last scene in Blade 3. Sorry, spoiler alert for anybody who hasn't seen Blade 3. Blade like is presumed dead at the end of the movie. And so they have him on a slab in the morgue. And Wesley Snipes refused to open his eyes as the reveal that he's still alive. So they had to CG his eyes opening because Wesley Snipes refused to open his eyes for the last scene.
Oh boy.
He was done with everyone and the film, it sounded like. And he's like, no, I'm dead. I'm not coming back. Don't bring me back.
Yo, stop your grinning and drop your linen. Found him.
My fun fact from that movie is that the hideout was actually an old McDonald's boat that they made for Expo 86. And it's, this is true. I went to Expo 86 when I was a kid, and I went.
So did I.
Everybody did that year, right? And that was, it was a big deal. But it was like, there was a McDonald's boat. It was an actual boat that was a McDonald's, and you could go in there and order your food. And I had a McDLT in that thing. I guess it just got, whatever, when Expo ended, it just got parked somewhere, and it kind of like fell apart and wasted away and everything. And then it was just on the side, and they, I guess when they were shooting this movie, they saw this and they said, can we use this as our hideout, and they did. So when they're at, like, whatever they are, their main base is in, I don't remember, is Christopherson in that one? I don't remember if he's in that one or not.
Briefly, I think, isn't he?
Yeah, that's where it is. That's where it is. When you see Chris Christopherson and all that stuff, that's where their base is. McDonald's.
McDonald's. Oh my God.
Sorry. Tangent.
Yeah. No, that's a good tangent.
One thing I want to tell you.
Because that's a set of restrictions. Right?
It is.
We have, yes. We have to work with what we have. What do we have? An old, rotten McDonald's boat. Mm-hmm. Can we make this part of our film set?
The interesting thought that came to me as you were talking about these comparison statements that we make in order to convey what this thing is about, you know, they're often used in the pitch meeting, but they're very rarely used in an actual trailer or marketing materials for these items. You don't see people marketing the Hunger Games as is this meets this, you know, it's the Hunger Games. They're figuring out other ways to do it. So I don't think that, while that is good in pitching an idea for a studio to a studio or to a production company, I don't think it necessarily goes forth into the marketing as well.
At some point it falls away.
Yeah. Right. Well, they don't want you thinking about those other properties. They want you thinking about the thing that they want you to go to. Right. So they
unless the studio backed those other properties,
right.
Because
yeah.
then it's the studio right. that brought you this and this, which
yes.
you like,
oh,
and here's
yeah.
another thing that's like it. Mm.
I right? hate that too, though. From yeah. the mind of M. Night Shyamalan. What does that mean? It means he thought
yeah.
of it, and then somebody else took it and did something. Like that's that Devil movie. Do you remember that movie? Speaking of all,
yeah.
oh yeah,
that was
yeah.
from the mind.
I have never been led astray by any movie from the mind of Guillermo del Toro. Like when he's producer or when he's like someone who's like cast his umbrella to help a other filmmaker make a film, it's always worth your time to have watched that movie. The people that he sees as being a talent worthy of notice and lends his name to.
But so is that kind of going back to what I said before? He's succeeded enough that the you don't need a comparison. It's just a del Toro project.
Yeah.
It's no longer some random trying to make Star Wars. It's just Del Toro is the brand, the thing you trust.
Now, if I saw a trailer that said from a random who's just trying to make Star Wars, I'd go see that. I'm in.
That's
right.
I'm sure that's a good indie film. Yeah. But when you healed, as I agree, as soon as I hear that Del Toro's involved, I'm in. Right.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter the genre.
To the honesty again, right? He becomes a proven entity that you trust. You know, people's tastes are related to that. It's mm-hmm. why you can follow producers, right? Like,
yeah, Tarantino, right? Like, you kind of know what you're in for with a Tarantino film.
That's right.
It's brand. It's a whole genre by yeah, exactly.
Yeah. 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 It's funny too because we're talking about people who have had long careers, well-documented careers, who have said these things themselves. So I'm paraphrasing like 100 interviews I've seen from the guy. But he had to start with some very specific, very stringent restrictions, even in his early filmmaking. You know, if you watch Reservoir Dogs, you know, it's a film in one location, essentially. There's a couple of other scenes that occur, but it's one location and it's lockdown cameras and it's, you know, it's everything that you can control.
And you don't actually see the scene that would have required lots of special effects.
Yeah.
Like there is
the actual,
right. yeah.
the yeah. bank heist, yeah. you don't see because you can't, he could never have afforded to shoot that. So it's the yeah. aftermath of it, right? But what also makes it interesting is because you've seen every bank heist movie before that.
Exactly.
And so you know exactly,
exactly
what he's talking yeah. about. You don't have to. Yeah. And that's the thing about giving the fans what, you know, when we talk about fan service, that's getting it right. Right? I'm going to make a heist movie where you don't see the heist. Okay. Well, then the characters yeah. better all be representative of the characters we've seen in other heist movies. And Reservoir Dogs is that. Right? But if you're going to make a film and then not give people what or just tell a story and not give people what they want. Like, for example, this reminds me of, we were in New York Comic Con. Remember shows, Justin? Well, it was so long ago.
We
were in New York Comic Con, and across from us, is a person selling their book. They have enormous booth, all these books. They're trying so hard to sell them. It's just falling flat. People are not getting it unless the author is able to speak to them. Whenever the author tells them the content of the book, they make a sale while I'm watching this. And I found this very interesting. So when I took my break from the booth at that time, I was with Z2, when we were there at with Z2 Comics, I went and just watched and listened to the whole thing. I wanted to see what was going on, like why no one wanted this book. But when they met the person, they walked away with it. And it came down to the slug line that they were using, which involved mech dragons. It was like to fight other dragons, they had to make these mechanical dragons, and pilots of mechanical dragons fight other dragons. If you have dragons in your book, right, and you don't have dragons and mech dragons on the cover, no wonder.
Oh, there you go. I was going to say, right? This is just like, so it's Mecha Godzilla.
It's Mecha Godzilla, but with dragons, right?
Yeah.
There you go. And then we've done it. We've reduced it to its own thing.
Yeah.
But the lead was completely buried. This is somebody who didn't have a marketing person say, actually, putting the two love interests on the cover is the wrong choice. Right? That's not why people are going to buy your book, because it's a heartfelt drama. They might, but that's not really escapist science fiction. Is about dragons. People love dragons. It's a proven entity. Right?
And they love robots, too, to be honest.
Exactly.
Robots and dragons.
And you have neither of those things in the marketing materials, in the booth design, right? None of that is there. But when they would finally, the author would explain, like, that the like who the characters are the pilots of these, like, mech dragons, I was like, whoa, I'd buy
That's
that.
That's the perfect place to sell a book about mecha dragons is Comic-Con.
Yeah.
You should let people know. Yeah,
it looked like a romance cover with some really bad graphics.
That
design.
Actually, that reminds me of Claire C. Marshall's display. When you guys did, why am I blanking on the name of your book, her book?
Gear and Sea.
Yeah, thank
Gear
you.
And Sea.
Gear and Sea. When Gear and Sea came out, you know, of course, she created the backdrop for it, like the cover of the book, I think. I can't remember exactly. But she also had a sign that said, robots. You know what I mean?
And yeah.
Sign that said something else. Because she had, like, these two sides to her thing. One was, like, for the Gear and Sea. The other one was for her other fantasy-based series or whatever it was, whatever she was promoting at the time. But I love that she just has a sign that says, robots. Like, that's all you need to know. Robot.
Yeah,
when your eye ran across the top of her, it was like fantasy, robots, and I forget what the other thing was.
Yeah.
But, you know, it just like your eye, you knew what you were in for just by scanning. And you're like, oh, I like robots. I'm going there.
Yeah.
And when we talk about making genre and how genre gets made, this is the material that we're talking about. Like, understand what it is you're trying to do. Understand that fans are there for any version of that thing. Right? I'll almost read any vampire story. That's how rooted and changed my DNA, my reading DNA was by 15-year-old Gregory reading Dracula.
Yeah.
I'm up for any of it now as a result. It's why, like, vampire fiction is its own thing, because there are millions of us out there. Right. The same with Cthulhu mythos stuff. Right. Like, if you're into it, you're up for all kinds of versions of it. And you see it now in the marketing of so many films that are trying to encapsulate gamer culture. Right.
Right.
They see that there's literally a culture that is not understood by average people, but is still inhabited by millions and millions of people. And if we could sell movies to them, wouldn't that be great? If we could sell books to them, wouldn't that be great? Right? But they have their headsets on and they're already doing what they spent their money on. So I don't know if we're going to be able to track
it. Has it really worked yet? Like, they keep trying.
No.
The last one I can remember is like the World of Warcraft movie was... Look great, but
I heard it wasn't too bad.
I
heard it wasn't too bad if you were a fan of Warcraft. Like, it does make sense to those who know the world.
But yeah, they haven't done what comic books have finally managed to do, right? But comic books had a long, hard road to get there as well, to kind of jump genres into movies.
Do you know that it is directed by Duncan Jones, the Warcraft movie?
Yeah.
Do you know who Duncan Jones is?
He's son of David Bowie.
That's right.
Sleep tight.
Affirmative.
So this is like one of those things where like not giving people too much information. Where like that information, if Duncan Jones went around telling everyone I'm the son of David Bowie, let me do things creatively, people wouldn't. But he,
well, if it was purposely musical, they might.
And now he has a, I don't know if they would. And I think he would have to, that's a heavy weight around his neck the whole time. And I like, he works really closely with, he does a lot of comics work also. And in the interest of full disclosure, his new book is released from Z2 Comics, which also I've done a book with. So I'm, you know, defensive of the brand Z2 because they treated me well. But, you know, he did Moon, and he's got, and that world, the story of Moon, he's sequelized as graphic novels. You can read more of that world as graphic novels.
I didn't know that.
He also did Mute was in that same
movie.
Universe.
I love Mute.
Yeah.
That was next.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And so when someone of that quality and caliber as a filmmaker who is like totally excelled in a genre that his very famous father was part of, but wasn't, you know, the leader of, he was never steering the ship of the movies he was in. He was just part of them. When someone like that wants to do a movie like Warcraft, you kind of want to let them go. And I feel like there is nothing of him as a filmmaker on that screen, and everything of the studio, like the same way that, what was the movie I just watched? Oh, Hellboy, the Hellboy.
Golden Army.
Reboot.
The Hellboy reboot.
Yeah.
By Neil Marshall.
Yeah.
Neil Marshall wasn't allowed to do any Neil Marshalling. You hire Neil Marshall and then you don't let him Neil Marshall in his own movie. Why would you let? And I recently listened to him interviewed about that exact thing where he was just like, okay, well, I realized I have to do the best job they'll let me do, but I'm not able to do the job I could do because no one will let me. Mm-hmm. I feel that about Warcraft. I feel like the bones of a really amazing science fiction epic are there. And then they're like, no, we should do more CG troll fighting.
Yeah, it happens all the time. And what sucks is that, you know, that's now like a stain on his portfolio, on his career. Like, he's the guy behind the terrible Hellboy reboot. Nobody's going to blame people are going to blame him as much as the studio, right?
Right. Yeah. In fact, I couldn't believe, I was halfway through that movie, I was like, I thought this was a Neil Marshall film. That's what I kept saying while I was watching it. How is this so bad? He's such a talented filmmaker. How can it be so bad? And there's only so much fighting you're willing to do. You know, like you see, you know, this brings us back around to the beginning. We're talking about Aliens 2 or Alien 2, Aliens. If the director is willing to fight every day and have a disagreement with every person every day, then they can be an auteur filmmaker. But I don't think you have that in you for every project.
For Hellboy or for Warcraft. Maybe it was a film that you wrote and conceived of yourself, like your own, like Memento or something like that, your own little baby that you are raising yourself and creating yourself, then you would probably fight for it. But if it's just like a big budget action blockbuster thing that you've never, you know, involved with, then you probably won't want to fight anything.
You spend your days daydreaming about the next project. You have this big fat paycheck from the Warcraft movie. So now you can make a really great movie on your own next.
Mm-hmm. You
That's
wonder
what I imagine
about
some of these directors paychecks. Are doing. Yeah.
You wonder about those big fat paychecks though, because like, you know, Joss Whedon has lately been a fairly problematic figure in Hollywood, but just talking about his accounting, he released at one point the idea that Dr. Horrible's sing-along blog, which they produce themselves and own outright, has made more money from Dr. Horrible's sing-along blog as a steady source of income than he made from Avengers.
That's crazy.
Right?
That's
so that, right? This is just, you'll take a job, I think. Well, I mean, we've all been there. We've all been offered things where you say, okay, I don't know if that's right for me, but that money would really help what I'm doing now. Right. Yeah. And anyone listening to us, dear listener, I feel that for you. I feel so deeply. Those of you who have felt that feeling of subverting some piece of yourself or your principles for the sake of a dollar, it's the worst. But sometimes you really need that dollar.
It's not just the dollars though. Like you definitely are going to learn some things and pick up some new skills and, you know, have to make something that you wouldn't make yourself. I've learned like some of my best tricks I've learned from doing something that I thought I'd get nothing out of. And it turns out like, oh, I've learned a whole new skill set that is really useful. So
I do think
there's some useful things to gain other than the dollar from projects like that.
So I brought it up earlier, the idea of meaningful struggle, right? I don't mind working really hard for a dollar, but I want it to be representative of my desires and not somebody else's desires, right? Like I have, in fact, many times I've opted, you know, argued in a contract to be paid less so that I own more. Right. Which means now I'm going to have to work twice as hard because I'm going to have to do this project, which I'll now get paid at maybe half my rate so that I own the IP at the end. And now I have to take on another project so that in the course of that 6 or 12 months, I earn enough to support the family because my stupid principles got in the way of wanting to own it.
I think that's a decision that's going to be beneficial for you down the road. I think one of these characters is going to you own all your own work, and one of these is going to hit and you're going to benefit from it. And it's going to be awesome. You're going to have your own Dr. Horrible. Yes.
As long as there's singing in it, I don't have to sing. We'll get professionals.
I don't know if you guys have played Breath of the Wild yet, but I named my horse a Breath of the Wild bad horse. So I was trying to think of all these different horse names. I'm like, oh yeah, bad horse. Anyway, you got to wrap it up.
You know, okay. I'm going to just make a brief digression here. Sure. Speaking of horses, to way back in the day when Red Dead Redemption first came out, and I'm a cowboy loose in the new frontier, and I am riding my horse, and I'm like, wow, the world is so expansive and so immersive, and oh my god, I went over this hill and my horse died. I had to stood in this virtual world for 20 minutes trying to figure out if there's a way to revive my dead horse that I had worked so hard to get. I mourned that dead horse in that video game. Because nobody told me that Grey Wind was not going to be my horse forever.
Grey Wind. Nice name.
And his poor broken body at the bottom of that ravine that I just had to leave there.
So did you jump off of him midair? What happened there?
Yeah, no. And then here's the most horrible part of that. Those of you who've played Red Dead Redemption will know this, but I was a noob and I didn't understand that there was that skinning feature. So I'm trying to revive the horse and I pushed X or Y or square or whatever. And suddenly my character gets down, takes out his boy knife and skins the horse. Oh my God. And so it's bloody mangled corpses there, which I have now been the cause of. I was traumatized, you know, and I'm an adult.
Well, now
person.
It's really not coming back.
Yeah, no. It was the worst. So, you know, full immersion. We don't have to keep that part in the podcast necessarily, but oh man, my mind went there when you talked about your horse. Right. Having never owned a real horse, only my virtual horse. Right, brought me. Okay, so we're going to wrap it up. Should we hit another point or should
sure,
we
if you
just...
Sure, you can do one more. Let's do one more. More point.
Okay, so...
What's
given...
What's Go ahead. I was just going to ask about your addiction. You said you want to talk about your something addiction.
Kickstarter.
Kickstarter. Oh, that's a big topic. Maybe we'll say that for next week.
Yeah, we can save that for next week because we're going to talk about a couple of Kickstarter related things next week, I think. So yeah, we can save it for that. But I have definitely, between you and me, backed too many things on Kickstarter recently. What was I going to say? Restrictions. Oh, okay. So obviously one of the biggest restrictions that all of us are in is this inability to see and collaborate and to meet with each other as we used to do. How are you guys finding that's affecting your project collaboration? I know in Justin's specific case, it's meant he's been more open to more people collaborating on books. I don't know what the follow-up on those three or four meetings you've been having with folks, Justin, have been, but I find that to be like one of the biggest restrictions is you can't go to shows. And it's for you turned into, well, maybe I'll do a whole bunch of more books.
Yeah. Focus is, has just kind of shifted to, I don't know, just being more open for bigger, long-term, like freelance and projects for hire. Like I'm still being very picky and choosy, but now I'm not on the road so much. I can actually do these things. Whereas before, like even if I wanted to do them, it was just too hard to really put in the time these projects deserve. So I'm kind of seeing this as an opportunity to pursue more things that that I would have had to pass in the past.
And how about you, Dan? You've been doing more podcasting stuff, and like you can't do shows, you can't organize fan quests, or maybe you can. What have you guys?
It's been very quiet on the fan quest front for a while because we're just waiting. You have to wait. You can't really plan anything out. I'm starting to think about dates for 2022. I think that might be the closest I can get to having a show. But I will say that I've been teaching. Like my other job, of course, is to be an instructor at Red River College, and I miss teaching in person. Boy, do I miss it. There's a whole level of connection that you lose with your students when they're on this platform, on Zoom or whatever we're using. You want to believe that the students are all like paying attention and looking at the screen and doing that, but the truth is they could be doing a multitude of other things. And when you're at home and you're comfortable and you're used to like your own workflow and you're clicking away and looking at stuff on the internet, I'm sure that's happening during class time, and they're missing stuff. They're missing stuff that they normally would pick up because I'm there in person with them. There's also, I find, a reluctance of people to ask questions over these things. I don't know why that is. They have no problem asking them in person in the classroom, but more I find that I get a lot of questions later as opposed to in there in the class. And of course I prefer to have them in the class because then all the students can hear the answers and I don't have to repeat myself 10 million times. But
Because it's like hyper focus on them, like the Zoom camera switches to just their face versus maybe,
there's certainly that part of it. People are you know, probably the least favorite part of this whole thing is that they have to share like their what their home looks like, although some people go to great lengths to dress their set and do things with the background. I find other people are just like they almost never put their camera on because they don't want to, you know, something might be going on or whatever. Yeah. So you want to share that part of it. So there's that, but I mean, it is what it is. We're doing the best we can. It's going okay. But I do miss in person. I do miss talking to people. Every time I see a movie or a TV show that has a scene where there's lots of people, I want to be there. I want to just jump into that crowd of people and say, yes, we're doing this again.
I've definitely been missing our seminars and our like book breaking that we would do in groups of 20 people, Justin. But one of the things that I found, same thing. I've been doing some classroom work and stuff like that. With a big group, it's really hard via the little screen. But what I have found is really feels like it used to, is like doing one-on-one teaching. That really works. Like in a way that I was surprised at how much, like when I'm working with, you know, I worked with half a dozen people in the last few months on their manuscripts and on their work. And just you can build that trust again, one-on-one, in a way that is completely absent in a group Zoom meeting. where they get all the attention and they're able to respond completely or challenge the idea and all the, if there's a break in communication, you know, like even we have to deal with it on the podcast where there's a lag or whatever, it waits until they catch up, right? They don't have to catch up to the speaker. The speaker is waiting for them and back and forth. And the one-on-one component I've found surprisingly engaging for me as a teacher. And exactly what you're saying with a larger group, after it's four or five, if it's larger than three or four people, almost impossible to get any kind of feedback or engagement about the thing you're actually talking about. Mm-hmm.
I've been doing private podcast lessons, actually, another thing I've been doing lately. And so they're one-on-one like this, like just, you know, me and the person over Zoom, and it's going very well. That's fine. Yeah. But it's the group setting that's really frustrating. So.
Yeah. So those restrictions, right? You have to know what they create for yourself, right? Like we now know that teaching big groups on Zoom, hard to make that level of engagement. Teaching one-on-one by Zoom, really deep engagement. So
that's very interesting.
Right? Just all that kind of stuff. Well, gentlemen, this has been Super Pulp Science, where we have talked about all the little boxes we found ourselves in below these past 12 months. But we've just made stuff anyway, doing the best we can with what we've got. I'm your host, Gregory Kamichek, encouraging you to join the fight and make comics.